Pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate, you're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, dear listener. We're up to episode 59. It's the 24th of August. I am the Iron Fist. With me is the Velvet Glove. Scott, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Trevor. How's yourself?
Pretty good. We had a good meeting on Sunday.
I'm pleased to hear that. Yeah, we did, yeah.
So we've got a few things on our to-do list and
yes.
A couple of good new members there, which is good to see. So
yeah, for sure.
So that was good. And, you know, the religious secular world has given us plenty to talk about again this week. It doesn't fail, does it, Scott?
It never fails to disappoint, does it?
No. So, touch wood, but so far so good. We're up to episode 59 and we haven't really struggled as yet to find material to fill in and out.
No, we haven't struggled at all. It has been easy to find material and, It's a little bit depressing in one sense that it is easy to find material, but it's also, it gives us a job.
Yeah, it does. It gives us something to do in our spare time. So
exactly.
So, you know, as we've been doing it, we're sort of building up a bit of a history as well, because our first topic is on safe schools. And we can remember way back in early episodes when we raised safe schools and how there were moves to have it banned, and then it was eventually banned and all this sort of stuff. So, but then it was reintroduced down in Victoria, I think. But anyway, we've got here a news item from ABC, a petition against the Safe Schools program with more than 17,000 signatures from the Australian Chinese community has been tabled in the New South Wales Parliament. And that's been tabled by the Liberal member for Epping, Damien Tudehope.
Yep.
The petition calls on the program to be scrapped in New South Wales schools. I guess they must be... So funding was scrapped by the Commonwealth, but maybe New South Wales is funding
I think funding is still going from the Commonwealth, but there was a reform that was put through to the program, so it was changed. Yes.
Right. Okay. So they're calling for it to be scrapped in New South Wales, saying it promotes a particular ideology, including gender fluidity, that is contrary to our cultural and belief system. It goes on to say, Mr. Tudehope, this is the MP who's lodging the petition, says, "One thing that our migrant communities have in common is that they won't allow anyone interfering with their parental rights, and programs like Safe Schools represent an attack on the rights of all parents," Mr. Tudehope said. And fine, one more thing before we comment on it, Scott. The petition says the program discriminates against children and parents from other cultures who have a view of sexual relationships involving male and female as normative. So there you go. That's the petition. What do you reckon?
Mr. Tudehope, nonsense. That is garbage. You know, it is absolutely ridiculous that anyone would say that this is an interference in parenting rights. It's garbage. It is absolute garbage. Yeah, I'm afraid that's all I've got to say about it. It's just rubbish. Yeah.
You know, it sounded to me, it smacked of the ACL. Because, you know, when Lyle Shelton gets on a program, you know, he dodges the rights of people to be treated equally in terms of gay people and hetero people, and reframes it in terms of you know, rights of the children, etc. And this is also dodging the key issue and trying to raise... really sort of peripheral issues and try and make them more important than the main issue, and to the point where they just seem ridiculous, doesn't it? Like
it is, yeah.
You know, well, the Chinese, does it just seem strange to you, the Chinese community gathering 17,000 signatures saying that this is contrary to our cultural and belief system?
It doesn't really strike me as strange that you would have a protest like this coming out of the Chinese community. I mean, they are fairly conservative. But, you know, 17,000 is a hell of a lot of signatures. And it makes me think that the Chinese were the front for the ACL.
Well, I think they are, because it just smacked of ACL to me with this. The way it was framed, you know, using culture and belief system, discriminating against children and parents from other cultures. It had all the cleverness of an ACL campaign. So I thought, well, who's this? Who is Damien Tudehope, this member for Epping, who has lodged this petition? And would you believe, Scott, that he's a former spokesman for Australian Family Association?
And the Australian Family Association is basically the ACL by another name.
Well, the Australian Family Association was founded by none other than B.A. Santa Maria. And Mr. Tudehope...
He's a Liberal member, wasn't he?
Yes. So Mr. Tudehope, who has 9 children and is a former spokesman for a Bob Santa Maria group, is the guy who's organised the petition. I mean, Bob Santa Maria was a famous Catholic anti-communist, and he was the mentor of Tony Abbott, and just a rabid social conservative. So look, call me crazy, but I reckon that he's just got his own beanie's bonnet and thought, oh, I'll just gather together a few signatures from the Chinese community and rustle them up. Like, you know, did that originate from the Chinese community or did it originate from him? Like, I have my suspicions, Scott.
Well, you're probably right to have your suspicions.
You know, particularly when Kenrick Chia, the president of the Chinese Australian Forum, said he had not heard about the petition until today, according to the news report.
Really? Yeah.
So that's the guy who's lodging the petition. A little bit more about Damien Tudehope. Well, there was a fellow in New South Wales, Father Egan, who was accused of, you know, the usual stuff in terms of abusing children. And Damien Tudehope was his solicitor. Tudehope's brother was the barrister who attended the police station when Egan was charged. Tudehope was the chief of staff for the Attorney General, Greg Smith. And Greg Smith used to attend Father Egan's church. And when the opposition was trying to get documents from the government about Father Egan, Damien Tudehope, as the chief of staff for the Attorney General, refused access to it. So eventually Egan was found guilty in 2013 of 7 counts of indecent assault and 8 years jail. But there's a guy right in the thick of the Catholic system, and lo and behold, produces a petition supposedly on behalf of, you know, generated spontaneously by the Chinese community in his electorate. Just funny that it happened to be his electorate and no other, I think, coincidence.
When you lay it out like that, it is a little bit hard to believe that it was just purely out of the Chinese community. I suspect he's probably got the ear of a group of conservative Chinese people that he said, look, I'll get the rest of the signatures, but I need you guys to sign it first.
Yeah, yep. Well, rustle up your mates and do, like, bound to have been started by him. So,
yeah, for sure.
So anyway, it's interesting. You scratch the surface of these people and, goodness me, connections to Bob Santa Maria, that's about as...
Yeah, I mean, like, Bob Santa Maria, he's dead, isn't he?
Yes, he is, yeah.
Yeah, he's dead, yeah. And, you know, he's, yeah, he's, what's the word I'm groping for? His influence is going to be around for a long time yet.
Yes, indeed. I'm a very influential character. Religious instruction in Queensland. We've previously mentioned that we thought it was on the ropes, that, you know, the refereeing was counting them out. But alas, an article in the Brisbane Times suggests that it's got good connections with what's going on in the education department, and instead of scrapping the abominable religious instruction classes, they're just going to change the enrolment forms to make it clearer about whether someone's in a particular religion and whether they consent to being in a religious instruction class. And they're going to keep the classes going, Scott, which, say it isn't so.
I find that incredible that they are going just to continue, that they're going to continue to throw this, they're going to continue to throw the fuel on the fire like this. I mean, it's, you know, they've called it apart and they've decided to have this review principally because of the Windsor State School, wasn't it Windsor?
Mm, yep.
Yeah, that where it was banned. Mm. And, you know, what they found in that Connect materials was pretty disturbing stuff. Mm. But rather than doing the sensible thing, saying, righto, this is it, this is the final year, they're going to go through and just make sure that only signed up Christians are actually going to be sending their kids to the class.
Yeah.
I find that crazy that they're going to do that. You know, it's madness.
Very disappointing. Very disappointing. So,
well, I mean, clearly Kate Jones doesn't understand what's involved in the classes, I think.
Well, no one in the education department does, because it's up to the principals of each individual school to decide what program is taught in their schools, and the department has no records of what is being taught in these classes. So, you know, they had no knowledge and still don't. So I gather they're working their way through Connect materials trying to see what's in this stuff. But basically it's a situation where the Act allows them to just hand over responsibility to the principals, and if you've got a religious nutter as a principal, anything's possible in terms of what gets taught.
Yeah, and I find that really crazy.
Mm. Mm. Little story, friend of mine I play squash with lives in the western suburbs of Brisbane. His kids are taken out of the religious instruction class, made to sit on the veranda outside the room, which is not acceptable because they can still hear what's going on. And while they were doing that, there was about half a dozen of them who were outside the class, most of the kids inside the class, and a parent walked past and said, "What are you guys doing here?" And they explained, "Well, we're not in the religious instruction class because, you know, we believe in evolution and the Big Bang and etc." And they were abused by the parent for not being in religious instruction class. Just terrible. So my mate's brother, whose kid was also involved, stormed up to the principal's office to complain, etc. But this is the sort of thing going on in our state school system, Scott.
Ah. Yeah. Let's just take that back just a minute or two. I find that incredible that an adult would tell off a group of kids.
Well, when you're filled with religious fervour and zeal, you know, that's your job.
Yeah, but it's really maddening, isn't it?
That'll justify just about any behaviour. If you truly believe in it, then you see it's your duty. That's the problem.
It is a problem. It is a real problem.
We can still call it despicable, but that's, I mean, you know, people do this because they honestly hold these beliefs. So ISIS kills people because it honestly believes it's the right thing to do for their God. And, you know, that parent walking along honestly believes that these children are going to go to hell if they're not proper Christians.
Hmm.
Anyway, Scott, moving right away from religion momentarily, the murky politics of boardroom pay. And this is an article from the UK, but the, you know, the arguments all apply here in Australia.
Yeah, they do. Mm. Yeah.
So basically, between 1949 and 1979, the share of income going to the top 0.1% of earners actually fell from 3.5% to 1.3%. So the people at the very top, their share of the pie decreased. But since 1979, the trend has reversed. And according to the High Pay Centre, the average FTSE 100 CEO was paid 47 times more than the average employee in 1998. But by 2015, that had risen to 129 times.
Mm.
It's an enormous amount.
That is an enormous amount of money that the top executive is getting paid.
Mm.
It is absolutely incredibly... It's unjustified.
Mm.
129 times the average pay is wrong.
Yep.
You know, it really is wrong. 47 times the average pay, well, you know, by comparison, it's a hell of a lot better. It's not nice, but it is better, you know.
These guys would all do it for less. Like, or they'd find somebody else just as good who would do it for less. Like,
That is it. That is really it. You know, you've got to look at, over here, David Murray. He was the chief executive of the CBA for years and years and years.
Yeah.
He started there as a 15-year-old bank teller and worked his way up the corporate ropes and all that sort of stuff. He lived through it all when it was being privatised and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he didn't get paid anywhere near what his current success is getting paid.
Yep. Yep.
You know, now, in banking, for example, especially in Australia where it's a mature industry, it doesn't really matter if you've got Donald Duck at the head of the bank.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, you're still going to produce profits.
Yes, that's right. Yep.
You know, and I refuse to believe that someone who's getting 129 times the average employee's wages is going to be 129 times better.
Mm.
I fail to see how that's going to be the case.
Mm. So there's
Clearly there's got to be a differential between the top and the bottom. There has to be.
Mm.
But 129 times is outrageous, and it's just wrong.
So we've got laws now that remuneration packages have to be approved at an AGM for the top executives. So shareholders have a chance at certain times to object, and occasionally that has happened. But it doesn't seem to be enough in my mind. But yeah.
Well, the problem with that, Fist, is that you do get the... You do get the occasional objection, but the majority of the shareholding is held by the corporates and the superannuation funds and that sort of stuff. And for whatever reason, they always seem to bow down to the corporates and the CEOs and all that sort of stuff.
Because, Scott, it makes sense if it's... for a start, recruitment firms are employed to find CEOs. So... which recruitment firm are you going to use to find your CEO? The board's going to choose a recruitment firm that's going to recommend a high salary. Or this the sort of, not the recruitment firm, but basically they're getting consultants to make recommendations on executive pay as to whether they're appropriate or not. Well, which consulting firm are they going to bring in? The ones with a history of recommending a high level of pay or the ones with a history of recommending a low level of pay? And the guys on the board will like the idea of high levels of pay because that means their level of pay can also be consequently higher. So it's a bit for these shareholders, which you've got large superannuation funds, they want everybody at the top to be on really big money because then it justifies them being on really big money as well. There's no incentive for these people to actually rein this in. So that's the problem. If people are really, really selfish, there's not much that can be done about it.
No, that's true. But, I mean, it's, you know, if you could get down to 50 times the average income being paid to your CEO rather than 129 times,
then you could...
Well, it's going to be okay because you can then give a little bit to your employees, and then you can keep a sizable chunk for your shareholders.
Yeah,
you know, I find that incredible that the shareholders haven't really made a hell of a stink about that.
Mm.
You know, 129 times is outrageous.
Mm.
Now, you know, I mean, in Japan, I think the I think the differential is something like 10 or 20 times the average wages.
Right, yep.
You know, now, it's incredible that a country like Japan, which has for decades since the end of the last World War been the second largest economy on the planet, and it's, you know, it doesn't have this runaway rampant disparity in its society. Its society is still relatively equal.
Mm. Interesting stat given here in this article. The idea of an international market for CEOs has been used ad nauseum to justify high CEO pay, but there's little evidence to support it. One recent study found that 80% of CEO appointments in the Fortune Global 500 were internal promotions, and only four CEOs had been poached while they were CEOs of another company in a foreign country. So that's interesting. So many internal ones. So you're not needing to put these high
amounts. Go out and poach from somewhere else. No.
Pay these high figures to poach, because poaching isn't actually going on.
Well, this is it. And, you know, I mean, I love that final line of that paragraph. CEOs promoted from within seem to perform better than external recruits.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, it's madness that they continue to live in this world that says that you've got to pay this amount of money, you've got to go to New York, you've got to get the best from New York, and you've got to bring them over.
Mm.
It's madness.
Scott, we've got a few articles on euthanasia. So we'd previously mentioned about Andrew Denton accusing Tony Burke of being part of a subterranean Catholic force. Tony Burke came out and said that... Well, it wasn't his religious convictions that have influenced him on this issue. It was a friend living with HIV who was given 6 months to live that guided his views on assisted dying laws. He said that his friend had said that he would not be around. He would probably have taken it up and he would be dead. I just think that's a nonsense argument. Like... The whole point of euthanasia is you're in pain, you're clearly going to die in the near future, a painful and ugly way that you want to avoid, and you pull the trigger early to stop that happening.
Exactly. But,
you know, this guy is obviously still alive and kicking. He wouldn't have... The whole idea is he wouldn't be meant to be utilising the euthanasia laws until his life had become, you know, unbearable.
Unbearably insufferable. Yes. Yeah. I find that really maddening to read this. He had HIV. It hadn't even gone into... It hadn't even progressed to full-blown AIDS by that point.
Mm.
Now, he was saying that he would not be around because he'd been given a prognosis of 6 months.
Yep.
If he'd lobbed up in the Northern Territory at the time when the laws were there and he said, I'd want to die, they'd say, why? And he said, well, I've got HIV, I've only got 6 months.
Yeah.
And they'd say, well, come back to us once you've lost control of your bowels and all that sort of stuff. We'll talk then.
Exactly.
You know, it's crazy that I
just because your friend doesn't understand...
Far be it from me to point the finger at Tony Burke, but I would be... very suspicious as to whether or not his friend actually exists.
Oh, I think he does. But just because your friend doesn't understand the law and how it would have worked, even in his own situation, doesn't make sense that Tony Burke just accepts that. Like, he should be able to go, well, mate, actually, it wouldn't have worked like that. It would have worked something different. So I'm still in favour of voluntary euthanasia. Like, just because your friend misunderstands it doesn't mean you have to swallow his story.
Exactly.
So that's just really frustrating. But
yeah,
if people really want to get a deep down personal look at what would it actually be like in this situation, there is a really, really good article that I've linked to, which is entitled, I Arrived at My Friend's Party. A few hours later, she died exactly as planned. And it's about a lady called Betsy, who's in the final stages of ALS, a neurodegenerative disease. that is slowly depriving her of the power to move, speak, eat and breathe. And she's in the final stages. The way that you die in this with this illness is you basically suffocate to death at the end. And she went as long and as hard as she could in a very tough struggle against her own body, and then basically decided to take advantage of the Californian voluntary euthanasia laws and basically called her friends in for a ceremony, which was a goodbye ceremony. And it's a really well-written piece. It was a little bit like a wedding sort of thing. They called it some sort of rebirthing ceremony.
Rebirthing ceremony, yeah.
And the rules were that, number one, no crying in front of Betsy. Number two, only joyful and light interactions. And number three, Betsy may cry in front of us. And they had cocktails, etc. They divided up her clothes and possessions. None were allowed to be left behind. They had a dinner. And eventually then Betsy made her way to a separate room where she was given drugs which she had to swallow herself. And there was a bit of worry as to whether she could do that and hold the drugs down and not throw them up, which she managed to do and managed to pass away. And it's about a 10 pages, but it's a really beautifully written, sad, but sort of...
It is a sad, but it's also a beautiful story.
Yeah.
I always start reading these things with a fluoro in hand, and I only got 2 or 3 pages in, and then I realised I hadn't fluoroed anything.
Yes.
Because I was just reading it. Yeah. It was really very good.
Yeah.
It was... It is the sort of exit I would like to have.
Yeah, I agree. I think the same. If I was in that position, that would be the undoubtedly how you'd want to go if you were faced with what she was faced with.
Yeah, exactly. Oh. It was. I did like this line, and it's in the final page. I can't help but wonder what could have been if my father-in-law had an end-of-life option. It's not for everyone. But for Betsy, it was the best path. Does the law change the way we die? And it doesn't, but it the law in that respect did change the way she died. It did make it more, for want of a better term, pleasant for her.
Yep.
And it was, I'd encourage everyone to read it. It's really very powerful.
And undoubtedly great for her as a way to go out. And also great for her friends as a way to say goodbye. And
did you notice none of them said goodbye? They said, "I'll see you later."
So really, really moving piece. If you we often say we have these articles, and you can find the link and read them. But if you've never read any of our links, that would be the one to read out of all the ones we've done in 59 episodes, I reckon, Scott.
Yeah, it is. It really is. Yeah, it really is very powerful. Mm. Yeah.
On the same topic, different article. Belgium has euthanasia laws, and they're basically finding they've got euthanasia tourists rushing to Belgium. With a staggering 2,023 medically killed last year. It's not surprising, is it?
Well, no, it's not surprising. And then finding that most of them are Brits. And the reason why the Brits are going there is because they can't do it in their own country. You know, it's absolutely crazy that the British government... I think the British government is going to have a debate on it. I did remember reading something some months ago saying that the Brits were going to have a debate on it. But it is crazy that they can't take their own life in their own country.
Nearly 300 Britons have travelled to Zurich to die with the help of Swiss suicide group.
It's and here it is here. The British authorities should understand that death tourism is the result of insufficient legal instruments to enable sick people at the end of their lives to seek help at home, permitting them to die peacefully in the company of their family and friends in a warm and loving environment. Hear, hear. Mm. You know, that is absolutely true. That if Britain wants to stop the death tourism, then they've got to change the laws in their own country.
Mm. I seem to recall when we were speaking about Victoria with the laws that they were looking at introducing.
Yeah.
And one of the key things I remember was that you had to be a resident of Victoria for a period of time before you could take advantage of the law, which was to sort of stop that tourism aspect.
Yeah, that's what the whole thing's been designed to do. Mm. I'm not convinced that's the right way forward. I mean, like, if Queensland buries its head in the sand, which I suspect it will, and refuses to do anything on that thing, then I would like the option to move to Tasmania or Victoria or something like that and take our option.
Well, that's what you do, wouldn't you? Like, if you had some sort of incurable disease that you know is going to, you know, take a few years but will wear you down and it's going to get ugly at the end, you would look at the time frames involved and you would make a move to another state if necessary. Yeah.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, I gather Tasmania's looking at it too, you know. So Tasmania and Victoria, well, Victoria's leading the country the whole way, but, you know, Victoria and Tasmania could end up being the progressive states in the Commonwealth.
It's a bit like when J.B. Jolkey-Peterson abolished death duties, then all these people from other states started moving to Queensland.
To die, yeah.
Yeah, and then the other states saw that was happening and had to cave in and abolish death duties as well, because basically they were losing their older, wealthier populations to Queensland.
Yeah, exactly.
Scott, a couple of articles from John Menadue's blog. One of them by Brian Tui about the quality of intelligence advice and just basically calling into question the military advice that we have. And, you know, I like it because, as you know, I've got a big thing happening about the subs. But he's saying that there's been a military security takeover of Australia's foreign policy. Little public attention has been paid to this change. It's reflected in the ready access that military chiefs now have to prime ministers. A few decades ago, they would be lucky to get in the door more than a couple of times a year. And the implication is that they're in there in meetings, you know, every second week. Plus, Whitlam, Fraser, Hawke, Keating governments did not take it for granted that Australia would participate in every war involving the US. But since then, there's been a reversal of that, and we seem to be automatically backing America's decisions. And he makes the point the next US president is a hawkish Hillary Clinton, which will almost she'll almost certainly be more aggressive than Obama. And he's just saying that, you know, Scott Morrison, now he stopped the Chinese and Hong Kong firms from leasing Ausgrid's wholesale electricity distribution business, and at the time Scott Morrison said that the distributor provided critical power and communications services to businesses. Well, it turns out that they provide power, but they don't provide any communication services at all, yet nobody in the media picked that up. Also going on about just having a go at the media again, saying that about the census, although almost no one knew the cause initially, journalists promptly quoted supposed experts, such as the director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, Peter Jennings, who had no better clue than the average lamppost. Jennings confidently nominated the Chinese government as the source of the cyber attacks that allegedly crashed the site. So with media like that and with military security advice like we've got, we're potentially headed for a world of pain, Scott.
Yeah, it is. It's just reading the thing, it looks as though inexorably we're marching towards a war with China. You know, it's which is rather disturbing when you read it. It is. I hope he's wrong. I think that's probably the only way to put it is I hope he's wrong, because it's pretty hard to argue with him the way he's got everything laid out there.
Well, he's just going saying we don't have a decent media criticising things, we don't have decent military advice, where anything's possible. Well, I think he's right.
Yeah.
Also on John Menadue's blog, a bit of an article, we won't go into it much, but basically Tony Abbott admitting that he was wrong in opposing the Malaysian arrangement. And
he was wrong. It was the right thing to do. The Malaysian arrangement would have stopped the boats, and I loved it here where Menadue said he basically said the coalition had no interest in stopping the boats. All they wanted to do was stop Labor stopping the boats.
Yeah, I underlined that as well. Yeah, it's a good one. Interesting. I was listening to an interview with John Menadue on the Religion and Ethics Report. He's son of a Methodist preacher and a quite strong Catholic with very strong faith views, John Menadue. So just goes to show in a lot of his stuff, though, that he doesn't necessarily have to rely on that too heavily, but you can see a little bit of it in his refugee immigration stance, but he's still practical. So anyway, just interesting to know that he's got quite a faith, a strong faith background. We've mentioned before Sunday penalty rates, and I've said I would hate to have a job where I worked on Sundays, and if I did, I'd really want to be paid extra for working on a Sunday, because that would be a pain in the butt. And, you know, business will say, well, you know, if we paid people less, then we could employ more people, and everyone would be happier at the end of the day. And there's an article here that's saying, no, that's not the case. And the reason we can say that is because of a rare natural experiment that occurred because of standardised state-based industry award rates. And basically, New South Wales was behind the rest of Australia, so compared to Victoria, in that New South Wales only had time and a half for Sunday and didn't have double time, which was in Victoria. So over 4 years, the New South Wales Sunday rate was increased from time and a half to double time. And while it had an effect in the first year, after 5 years, they could look at it and say that it had absolutely no effect on employment at all, raising the Sunday rates to double time from time and a half. So, so yeah, there you go. So the reverse should be true, that if you were to decrease the Sunday pay rates from double time to time and a half, all you'll be doing is just shifting money from the workers to the employers. So a very good article, just where they've had a real-life example where they can compare the two states and manage to knock out the variables and do it with a real apples versus apples type situation. So very interesting study, that one, Scott.
It was, yeah. It's all laid out there. It's, you know, a very good article. I was surprised that there was not a wholesale slashing of labour in New South Wales, but it just goes to show that it didn't have any impact. You know, it was crazy that it's crazy that the employers are continuing this line, that they're saying it'll be a disaster, it's got to go, you know. It's crazy.
Scott, a bit of talk in the media about Germany could become the next European country to ban full face veils under proposal. And there's also been stuff in France with banning the
burkini.
The burkini. Got any thoughts on banning the veil and banning burkinis?
Yeah, we might have an argument here, but I don't find them confronting the way some people do find them confronting. However, I do understand the argument that's put forward that says that if you're entering a bank and that sort of stuff, your face must be visible.
Uh-huh.
So I can understand that you've got to have, you know, and in licenses, and passports and that sort of stuff, you should be photographing with your face.
Uh-huh.
So I understand banning them in certain circumstances. Germany, where was it? Here it is. The proposed partial ban is to promote security and national cohesion, de Mazare said, denying that plans to ban were appeasing the increasingly popular right-wing AfD party. I find that a little bit hollow. I think the AfD is probably behind the ban, not orchestrating it, but they are the reason for the ban, because it is something that their followers seem to be hell-bent on.
I reckon that we should be able to see somebody's face. So when it comes to the burkini, I don't have a problem with it, because every burkini I've seen in these pictures, the person's eyes, nose, mouth are visible. It's just everything else is covered up. And actually,
yeah,
often you'll see people at the beach in Queensland wearing a similar sort of outfit just for sun protection, where they're basically covered everywhere else. So you do see people in full body suits just for sun protection. So... don't have a problem with the burkini of that sort. As for just in the streets with the burqa and that, I think for our society to function as a civilised society, we need to be able to identify people. And you can only do that by seeing their face. So if there's things happening on the street in our society, we need to know, is that a male or a female, for starters? And if something happens, you know, somebody's injured, well, who are the witnesses? Who was there? We need to be able to roughly identify people. And and I really object to the full niqab or burqa, where I think the niqab is just the slit across the eyes.
Yeah, the niqab is just the slits across the eye. The burqa is the mesh over the eyes.
And,
but everything else is completely covered.
Yeah, and I don't care what they do, provided I can just see eyes, nose and a mouth, that people can be identified and you can read expressions for our society to work. I mean, could you imagine our society if we all went around with wearing balaclavas? What a horrendous! What would be the psychological effect on our society if we were all dressed like that?
It really would be crazy.
So,
it's
also, I mean, there was, you know, the difficulty is, isn't it, that you know, you want to allow people freedom to do whatever they want to do, provided it doesn't interfere with you, and. So I'm trying to mount an argument that, in fact, it does interfere with me if it's going to cause the breakdown of our civilization, which I think it would. If you cannot see anybody's faces in a crowd, what a miserable bunch we would all turn into. We'd be so isolated.
No, we would end up a very miserable bunch if everyone had their face covered, for sure. I find it hard to argue for the ban based on that argument that you were saying before, that you should be able to do whatever you want that's not hurting anyone else.
But
you are right. If you've got everyone's face covered, then you're going to have a miserable bloody existence.
I think that will actually harm our society in a very significant way if everybody's like that. So the other argument is, I mean, you might well be a very well-educated, liberal, Western Muslim woman who wants to wear a full face veil. I mean, it's theoretically possible, but given that you know that millions of women are forced to wear that when they don't want to, what kind of sisterhood is this that you would adopt that garb when you don't have to, when you know that people are being forced to? It's just such an abysmal lack of loyalty to the sisterhood to take on that gear if you've actually got a choice, when you know women are out there who don't. So, like, I might really like Western hats, I don't, but if I knew people being forced to wear them, you just wouldn't, as a matter of principle.
Exactly.
Not the best example, but you get what I mean. It's an...
I get what you mean. It is crazy that you've got a in Western Europe, you've got women that are flocking to cover themselves up, and then you've got in the Middle East where you've got women who put it on because they have to. You know, I find that ridiculous that you've got people that are rushing to cover up when they don't have to, but at the same time, just on the other side of the planet, you've got people being forced into it. It's madness.
They're just showing a lack of respect for those women who are forced to. So,
exactly.
Scott, last article probably on the Olympics, I'd say, for Rio. Just turns out that there was, of course, there was a chaplaincy service in the Olympic Games village. An article about a father, Leandro Lennon Tavares, and his interreligious team of ministers catering to the athlete's spiritual needs. There were five religions with permanent presence at the Olympic Centre: Christianity, both Catholic and Evangelical, Judaism, Islam and Hinduism. Oh, and Buddhism. So I'm wondering, Scott, with the Commonwealth Games coming up in the Gold Coast next year? It's probably 2 years' time, isn't it? It's in between.
2 years' time, 2018, yeah.
I wonder if there'll be a chaplaincy service there, and whether there'll be... Since this is the thing, they won't allow a secular group, I bet you. I mean, you'll have to be a religious group to get a look in. We should find out.
Well, I mean, that's why you should establish the Queensland chapter of the Satanist Temple.
You're reading my mind, Scott. Dear listener, I've been talking to friends, you know, and suggesting it to them. Like, well, if we go back to my friends at the state school in the western suburbs of Brisbane, I think it was Kenmore Primary, but I'm not 100% sure. And we were discussing this issue, and I said, well, you know, I'd love to be able to offer your kids and the other half dozen who aren't in the religious instruction class, I'd love to be able to offer them like a secular ethics class, but under the legislation, I'm not allowed to. It's only religious organisations who can. So, you know, enter, Scott, the Satanic Temple. Because if you just don the garb of the Satanic Temple and say, well, I'm a religious group, now you have to let me in. If I can just get two kids who say they're a member of the church, you have to allow me in. So that's a compelling thought. Now, I've put this to my friends, and their problem is they're really worried that their kids are going to be picked on for being Satanists in the classroom and in the playground. And, we're just gonna make Satanism fun. Like, anyway.
I just remember last week laughing the whole way through that gaying ceremony that you were reading about.
Yes, Look, dear friends, listeners out there, if you are half inclined to start the Satanists, Australian chapter of the Satanic Temple, Wayne, you know, you're out there, if you're one or somebody like that, I don't think I can, just with my position in the secular party. It's going to be too confusing for people. But, but I'd really, really like to help out anybody who was looking at doing it. So, yes, if you're half inclined out there, anybody, please give it a thought. Scott, meanwhile, back in Pakistan.
You know, hardly an episode goes by where we don't mention Pakistan,
yep,
you know?
Yep, yep. I mean, we've got drinking games, we've got the submarine and we've got the ACL, but I tell you what, if you put Pakistan as your drinking game word, for longevity, you're going to do very, very, very well.
You are, you know...
So this story...
Sorry, go on.
From the Washington Post, there's a little-known Pakistani tribe that loves wine and whiskey, but is fearful of its Muslim neighbours. And they're in the Kailash Valley in Pakistan, hidden up in the mountains near the border with Afghanistan. And look, they seem fun-loving, Scott. They love homemade wine and whiskey, and they have dances for days at colourful festivals. And they have a god that has spirits and messengers who speak through nature. But unfortunately for them, over the past century, Muslims from modern-day Pakistan and Afghanistan are moving in, and there's a clash of cultures going on. And we are scared, said one of these guys. They capture our lands, our pastures, our forests, and sometimes take our goats and women. We are afraid that in the next few years we will be finished. And they tell the story of one of their girls, a 15-year-old, who wandered away from home and unfortunately for her, ended up at the Islamic seminary. After a few hours, the cleric declared that this girl, Rina, had converted to Islam. She later returned to her village, saying she had not intended to convert. But angry Muslim villagers began pelting the Kailash villagers with bricks and stones, arguing that a conversion to Islam cannot be undone. A judge agreed, effectively severing ties between the girl and her parents.
That is really sickening, isn't it? That a judge would come down on the side of a religion. And, you know, we just had that earlier, the first story there where they were talking about how it's interfering in the rights of parents.
Yes.
This here is interfering in the rights of parents.
You know, what's worse? Your girl wanders off and gets raped, or wanders off and gets converted to Islam, and there's no... It's impossible to undo that. You're dead if you try and undo that. And off she goes, converted. What an appalling situation. What does it say?
You know, it's you go down here further. The Kailash villagers said 2 years ago, Taliban militants from Afghanistan sneaked into Bumbarat, the unofficial capital of the valley, and stabbed a 15-year-old boy to death. Yeah. I saw 25 Taliban from a distance surrounding the guy and killing him.
Yeah.
You know, it's really disturbing stuff.
Also says that one guy who's about 75 says that for much of his life, the Kailash and their new neighbours lived in relative harmony. But he and other villagers said the mood had changed over the past decade as a less tolerant form of Islam began taking hold here. Travelling Islamic scholars are increasingly showing up in the valley, and after each visit, villagers say, their Muslim neighbours appear less tolerant. Oh, doesn't that sound depressingly in line with that article we read a couple of weeks ago where the guy said... They get a toehold and then they get a further toehold.
It is depressing because you've got a, you know, you've got a small, little tiny pocket of people that are completely different from the rest of the surroundings.
Hmm.
And they've lived that way for hundreds of, if not thousands of years, and no one's ever batted an eyelid.
Hmm.
And then they turn around and they lose it all.
Mm. Oh, Scott, little bit of vocabulary work now, and definitions. This comes from the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe and a little page they've got called Logical Fallacies. And in all the reading that we do, we come across different things in comment threads and in different arguments, and you kind of get a gist of what it means, but you might never have really thought about it or looked it up properly. But so, an ad hominem argument. So sometimes you'll see, you know, people say, you know, I'll stop with the ad hominem argument. Well, that's an argument that attempts to counter another's claims or conclusions by attacking the person rather than addressing the argument itself. So I often talk about that as playing the man and not the ball. So that's an ad hominem attack. And have you heard of Godwin's law at all?
Godwin's law is you bring up Hitler.
Yes.
At every opportunity. Yeah.
Yes. Godwin's law is that the longer an internet discussion thread, the higher the chance of a Hitler or Nazi comparison. Which is true.
It is true, yes.
The other one was a false dichotomy, where you're arbitrarily reducing a set of many possibilities to only two. For example, evolution is not possible, therefore we must have been created. This assumes that these are the only two possibilities. Another argument you hear is the no true Scotsman argument. This fallacy is a form of circular reasoning in that it attempts to include a conclusion about something in the very definition of the word itself. It's therefore also a semantic argument. The term comes from the example: if Ian claims that all Scotsmen are brave and you provide a counter-example of a Scotsman who is clearly a coward, Ian might respond, "Well then, he's no true Scotsman." In essence, Ian claims that all Scotsmen are brave by including bravery in the definition of what it is to be a Scotsman. And Scott, I reckon the same thing happens with Islam or Muslims, where people are saying, well, they're not a true Muslim, based on their particular definition of what it means to be a Muslim. So this is where a lot of sort of problems occur in our argument about Islam and its effect on the world is this sort of thing about, well, who really is a Muslim or who is really following Islam? So that's why, Scott, my definitions, I reckon, I went through the, you know, five episodes ago that you kind of hinted at were, you know, unconscionable or something, were actually quite handy. Have you come around yet on that one or not really?
No, I haven't come around yet on that, no.
Okay. All right, I'm going to have to work on that.
You have to keep working on that one, I'm afraid, yeah.
The other one is a non sequitur, a Latin term translated does not follow. This refers to an argument in which the conclusion does not necessarily follow from the premises. In other words, a logical connection is implied where none exists. Two more to go through. We've got the slippery slope, arguing that a position is not consistent or tenable because accepting that position means that the extreme of the position must also be accepted. But moderate positions do not necessarily lead to the slippery slope of the extreme. So that's with, like, euthanasia, where some people will say, well, we can't allow euthanasia because...
In fact, Granny often get her knocked off.
Yes, in extreme circumstances, they're going to convince Nanny Granny to kill herself and get early access to the estate, you know. And finally, straw man argument. Attempts to counter a position by attacking a different position, usually one that is easier to counter. The arguer invents a caricature of his opponent's position, a straw man that is easily refuted, but that position, but not the position that his opponent actually holds. So, so you see that a lot where people saying, oh, all you secularists think blah, 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 and that's clearly rubbish. Well, in fact, all secularists don't necessarily believe in blah, blah, blah. You've just said that, but it's not true. It's a sort of a straw man argument.
Mm.
So they're good definitions to know, Scott, in the battle of ideas that we are engaged with. And I wanted to quickly, time-wise, I think I can rattle through this, that book that I was reading about the Vatican.
The Vatican and the what it's been up to.
Yes, yeah. Money, Murder and the Mafia, the Vatican Exposed. Finished the book, Scott. Second part, not as good
it's
as...
worth a read, is it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the second part, not quite as good as the first part, but still right. quite interesting. When we last left, we had Yugoslavia was divided into Catholic Croatia and Orthodox Serbia. We had Ante Pavelić was a prime minister, led the Ustashi, which were a bunch of fascist thugs. And we had Archbishop Stepanak. Well, that prime minister, after the war, Pavelić, was captured by the Americans near Salzburg. They were getting ready to send him to the Nuremberg trials, but Pope Pius XII somehow managed to get him transferred to the Vatican and then let him go where he and helped him stay on the run from authorities for the next 3 years. So just abominable, again, Pope Pius XII. And, of course, the Vatican had a thing called the Vatican Rat Line set up where they helped Nazis flee Europe. And the estimates are that up to 30,000 Nazis used the Vatican Rat Line to flee Europe and get to South America, Australia and other countries. So it talks about that. Post-war, the church really got big in the banking sector. Pope Pius XII eventually dies, thank goodness.
Not soon enough.
Yeah, not soon enough. Like, truly an evil character. Pope John the 23rd is elected, and he's a progressive character. And they thought he was going to be not around for long, but he was around long enough, and he brought about Vatican II, which was the ecumenical council that got rid of the Latin Mass and stuff like that. So after him was Paul VI, who condemned capitalism and was had a very imperialistic view of the Holy Office, and he's the one who issued the Humanae Vitae pronouncement in 1968, which was so anti-birth control. And the world is paying dearly for that ever since.
If he hadn't have done that, the world would be a much better place, wouldn't it?
Yeah, if we had birth control in developing countries, a lot of poverty would be immediately solved or just alleviated. Well,
I found that incredible that time that you were bringing up the statistics, and you know. Ethiopia went from a population of 20 million to 100 million or something like that.
Mm. Yep.
You know, it's crazy.
And global warming as well. So,
yeah, exactly.
Okay, 1969, the Italian government was a collection of socialists and communists, and they decided to revoke the Concordat deal that the Vatican was working with, the one that gave them all of their advantages in terms of tax, etc. And Pope Paul VI panicked and decided he wanted to hide the church assets as best he could. So he put in charge of the Vatican Bank and Vatican finances a guy called Michele Sindona. The only problem was that Sindona was a mafia boss, and Pope Paul VI knew that. And he liquidated the Vatican holdings, which devastated the Italian economy, and proceeded to hide them assets all around the world. But he also got the Vatican involved in fake bond scandals and just nefarious stuff that only the mafia could get involved in. And basically what would happen is they'd created fake bonds, and you think, well, how's this going to work? Eventually these bonds are going to be detected. Which they were, but the cardinal who was ultimately responsible disappears in mysterious circumstances, i.e. killed by the mafia, And because the Vatican is a sovereign state and cannot be sued and doesn't have to provide any details, the sort of financial investigations just hit a blank wall whenever the Vatican Bank is involved. So the mafia uses the Vatican Bank to conduct all sorts of terrible schemes, and when people are tracing back where did the money go, it ends up in the Vatican, and that's where the investigations stop. Then we've got Pope Paul the Sixth dies, and Pope John Paul the First is elected, and this is on the 25th of August, 1978. Tomorrow would be the anniversary, Scott.
Ooh.
He starts a purge because he knows that the finances and everything of the Vatican is just completely rotten, and he starts getting rid of people, and he tells very high-ranking people, tomorrow you're gone. Gets ready to oust Bishop Mark Kinkas from the Vatican Bank, and also to sack Cardinal Villot. He's going to make the announcement on the 29th, and guess what happens, Scott?
He dies on the 28th?
Correct. In, again, extremely mysterious circumstances. His doctor had only examined him a week before and said he was incredibly healthy. Like, he sounds like the healthiest pope that's probably been around in the last several hundred years. And he's lasted, you know, 32 days or whatever it was. Killed, as this book says, most likely by Cardinal Villot. Gives reasons why. All sorts of interesting tidbits of information as to why it was suspicious, the fact that he was embalmed, and all sorts of details. So if you're interested, it's all there. John Paul II was elected. He's the Polish guy. He's on side with the establishment, and various other mafia schemes still go on. The Ambrosiano affair, the Frankel affair, all money laundering type affairs using the Vatican Bank. So one of the best reads I've had in a long time, The Vatican Exposed. Highly recommend that one to anybody wanting to have a good look at the Vatican. Scott, we a few closing comments. We're up to, Scott, 97 likes on our Facebook page. And
yeah, we're only three away from me getting back to the helicopter.
Yeah, and what's happened with the helicopter? You get back in, do you, at 100 likes?
Yeah, I do that, yeah. Okay. If we get to 100.
Okay. Well, Scott, we've been on 97 likes for about 4 weeks. So, dear listener, you know, when you sort of started your podcast today, did you think to yourself, oh, great, Iron Fist Velvet Glove, really looking forward to this? Fantastic. Well, have you gone onto Facebook and actually liked our Facebook page? Or even better, have you gone onto the iTunes site and given us a 5-star review on iTunes? So it's not easy navigating iTunes. It might take 5 to 10 minutes of your time. There's detailed instructions on the website on how to do it. Couple of the wonderful 5-star reviews we've got from some people here. We've got one from RHHGDTGVV on the 19th of May, who said, don't listen to these baby-eating heathens. God will kill an angel for every episode that you listen to. but he or she, RHHGDTGVV, whoever you are, thank you for that.
We're really impressed by that, yes.
Aussie Comet said, excellent episodes 55 and 56, well done to the 12th man and the fist. Good, clear and succinct delivery of interesting topics. And there's a few other ones there. Of the 8 people who have rated on this thing, Scott, I reckon I know 5 of them personally. So, dear listener, if I don't know you personally, if you've been enjoying a fair chunk of the last 59 episodes and it's all free, hasn't cost you anything, and you're thinking a little bit of guilt is just starting to creep into your psyche, today's the day to get on and give us some likes, tell your friends, go on to the iTunes store and leave a review for us. A nice review would be good.
Let's see if we can get an even better review from the RH blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
One. Yeah. I mean, that was very good, yeah. But still in all.
Yep. And
something better would be great.
And look, to save you the normal disclaimer, as a treat, dear listener, we're members of the Secular Party. Our views may not necessarily represent the views of the Secular Party. For full details, check out the website. Okay. Saved you 20 seconds there. Scott, we're running over time. I think we might leave the Q&A episode and Brendan O'Neill until next time. Or are you really keen to do it this time?
No worries.
Yeah? We'll do it next time.
No, that's fine by me. We can do it next time.
All right, dear listener, thank you. Well, Scott is not with us. You're away at something, so we'll be...
No, I'm away next week, okay. So you'll have the 12th man.
We'll rope in the 12th man again. So, all right, Scott.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, dear listener. I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening.
Scott, we'll talk to you in a fortnight. See
you. No worries. Bye now.
Bye, everyone. Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf, on their phone, and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.